Well, hello and welcome again to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm your host, Bill Howell. Thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. We've got a lot of good stuff for you today, including an interview with Doug Hoag, owner of Kenai River Brewing Company. But first, let's get started with news items. Alaska's Alcohol Beverage Control Board has been in the news lately. The Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, the state office within the Alaska Department of Commerce that oversees the various types of alcohol licenses, recently conducted a review of the tourism alcohol licenses in the state. Tourism alcohol licenses are a type of license that specifically includes businesses that encourage tourism, according to Alaska statute. Typically, these businesses are hotels or lodges. The review, released September 13th, identified 34 of 165 tourism licenses that are not in compliance with the population limits, based on the number of hotel rooms they have available compared to the population in the municipalities they are located in. Quote, all 34 licenses that do not meet the statute do not have a sufficient number of hotel rooms, Erica McConnell, the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, wrote in a memo to the board. Of those 34 licenses, 76% have fewer than half the number of rooms required. On the Kenai Peninsula, 11 businesses don't meet the requirements, despite having had their licenses for a number of years and applying to renew them, which requires review by the board. 3 are inside city limits and 8 are in the unincorporated borough. It's unclear as of yet what action, if any, the Beverage Control Board will take on this matter. McConnell has also raised eyebrows and hackles around the state with a memo to the other board members requesting, quote, that the board clarify on the record its interpretation of the intent of manufacturing licenses and the parameters around extracurricular activities, end quote. Some of the extracurricular activities which concern McConnell were listed in the memo. These include yoga classes prior to the opening to the public, poetry readings and signings, sales of local crafts, yodeling competitions, and this is a direct quote, fun. Yes, you heard that correctly. The chairwoman of the ABC board is officially concerned about people having fun at breweries and distilleries and appears to be trying to outlaw it. Coming closely on the heels of the board's recent attempt to force distilleries to stop serving mixed drinks, it appears that McConnell firmly supports the efforts of Alaska's Cabaret Hotel Restaurant and Retailers Association, or Alaska Char, to hamstring the concept of direct sales by breweries and distilleries. I did a feature on this topic in September. At its November 13th meeting, the ABC board voted to table this matter until its next meeting at the end of January. On Friday, November 10th, Bear Paw River Brewing in Wasilla celebrated the launch of its Frontiersman IPA and mat-made milk stouts in 6-packs of 12-ounce cans. The brewery is also looking for Alaska photography to use on a series of beer can labels. It's looking to work with multiple local photographers on this subject. If you're interested, send photos to info@bearpawriverbrewing.com along with your name and the location where the photo was taken. If your photo is selected, Bear Paw River will contact you about the details. Kenai River Brewing Company held its first fall beer dinner on Saturday, November 11th. The sold-out event was a huge success with outstanding food and excellent beers. Much fun was had by all, likely to the chagrin of the chair of the ABC board, Ms. McConnell. The Soldotna Chamber of Commerce has announced the date for the next Frozen River Festival. It will be held on Saturday, February 17, 2018, in Soldotna Creek Park. Quake Brewing Company, which opened earlier this year in Wasilla, has closed for the winter season. With two new investors on board, the brewery is making plans to move from its current isolated location onto Fifth Avenue in downtown Anchorage. Anchorage Brewing Company released its Deal with the Devil box set on October 28th. Hundreds of fans camped out in 30-degree weather for 14 hours for a chance to pay $300 for one of the 440 custom-engraved boxes. Owner Gabe Flesher estimated that over 120 people flew into Anchorage to take part in the release. Each box contains six different versions of the brewery's award-winning barley wine packaged in 375-milliliter bottles. The Alaska Chamber of Commerce has announced that Denali Brewing Company and owner Sasson Mosasson has received the Bill Bivin Small Business of the Year Award. Established in 1993, the award pays tribute to businesses that exemplify leadership, ethics, and organization. The chamber stated, quote, Denali Brewing's incredible growth is fueled by Mosasson's passion for quality workmanship, clear communication, and community involvement. Personal traits that are reflected throughout the company. Denali Brewing is a model of the determination and sound judgment that drives Alaska's successful small companies. End quote. An Anchorage assemblyman has resurrected the idea of a local liquor sales tax to pay for community problems associated with alcohol and drug abuse. Assembly Chair Dick Traney wants a 2% sales tax on alcohol bought from distributors. This means Anchorage bars and liquor stores would pay more when ordering alcohol. The higher cost is generally passed on to customers at the bar or register. Revenue from the tax, if put on the city's 2018 ballot and approved by voters, would be dedicated to financing alcohol and/or drug treatment, emergency transportation, public safety purposes related to detrimental primary and secondary effects of alcohol or drug abuse, and housing programs, including housing programs for chronic inebriates, according to Traney's proposal. The assembly could raise the tax up to 6% over time. Quote, I keep getting calls from people saying, we've got to do something about alcoholism, said Traney, who said he does not drink alcohol. Traney isn't shy about tax proposals, but his biggest challenge has been getting his ideas past his assembly colleagues. Several assembly members said that they weren't totally opposed to the alcohol tax idea, but had to look at the details. Assemblyman John Weddleton of South Anchorage said he also wanted to hear public reaction. Quote, I am nervous about a special tax on a special brand of business that isn't responsible for all the ills of society, Weddleton said. Traney has tried at least twice to pass an alcohol tax, the first in 1994 and then in 2015 with the help of then-Assemblyman Ernie Hall. The most recent measure, which also sought to dedicate money to alcohol and drug treatment, drew fierce criticism from local bar owners and members of the liquor industry. Traney's assembly colleagues eventually killed the proposal, averting what appeared to be a big political fight. Traney said he has not spoken to the local chapter of the Alaska Cabaret Hotel Restaurant and Retailers Association, which represents bar owners. Anchorage alcohol retailers already pay a state tax on alcohol, which amounts to $12.80 for a gallon of liquor, $2.50 for a gallon of wine, and about $1 for a gallon of beer. Traney's alcohol tax proposal also asked voters to approve a one-time exemption from the city charter, which is like the city's constitution. City charter says sales tax needs 60% approval from voters, but Traney's measure calls for a simple majority. The Brewers Association, the not-for-profit trade association dedicated to small and independent American brewers, announced an agreement with the United States Department of Agriculture Agricultural Research Service to fund public hop breeding for the purpose of developing and releasing disease-resistant aroma hop cultivars into the public domain in support of hop growing efforts throughout the United States. The trust agreement between the Brewers Association and the USDA provides funding for a program located in Washington and Oregon to leverage significant existing academic and operational infrastructure. The research will prioritize breeding efforts in four areas. Sensory requirements as determined by the Brewers Association through a collaborative and participatory brewer and industry stakeholder program. improved downy mildew resistance, improved powdery mildew resistance, and improved agronomic performance compared to existing aroma cultivars. With the agreement signed, the USDA will move forward to hire a professional breeder and an operating partner facility will be secured. Kenai Peninsula College will be offering its beer appreciation course, The Art and History of Brewing, again during the spring semester. It will be taught by yours truly. The class meets each Tuesday evening from 5:30 to 6:45 on the Soldotna campus, with the course beginning on January 16th. We will learn about the history and styles of beer, sample a different beer in each class, and tour the local breweries. The class is worth one college credit. Call KPC at 262-0300 with any questions. So that's it for this month's news. Next up, we'll have our feature presentation on the history of alcohol in Alaska. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier with your host, Bill Howell, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. This is your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In this month's feature presentation, we'll be discussing a short history of alcohol in Alaska. Given how much time I spend on these shows talking about how the state of Alaska taxes, licenses, and regulates alcohol, I thought it might be cool if I took a few minutes to tell you a little about the history of alcohol here on the Last Frontier. When Alaska became a U.S. territory in 1867, it was declared Indian country in its entirety. At that time, total prohibition throughout Alaska was declared as an extension of U.S. Indian policy dating back to 1834. The primary rationale of this policy was the belief that Indians were dangerous while drinking, or at least they were more dangerous than whites, so prohibition was required to protect the Indians' health and the welfare of whites. The Customs Act, passed in 1868, specifically prohibited the sale, importation, and consumption of distilled alcohol in the new territory. The U.S. Army was sent to Alaska to enforce federal law, and according to that law, its members were the only persons legally allowed to possess alcohol within the territory. There was more than a little irony in this, as the post-Civil War Army was plagued by drunkenness and desertion. In fact, Alaskan legend has it that a soldier who had deserted from the post at Sitka and gone seawash, a derogatory term for whites who adopted a native-like subsistence lifestyle, first taught Tlingits in the village of Kutsnahu how to make and operate a still. This was the origin of Hootchinoo, the name applied to the crude rum produced by the Tlingits. Hootchinoo was eventually shortened to Hooch, common Alaskan slang for homebrew or moonshine. As a practical matter, there seems to be little evidence that the Army ever attempted to enforce any form of prohibition on non-Indian persons in Alaska. With the transfer of sovereignty, more and more American traders, explorers, and prospectors began entering Alaska, and they fully expected to be able to purchase and consume alcohol. In 1874, Levi Cohen Fuller and Company opened in Sitka, then still the territorial capital. This Sitka brewery shipped its products to Tongass, Wrangell, Kodiak, Stickneen, and other trading posts. This was the first commercial brewery in Alaska, and despite being technically illegal under federal law, it operated successfully until 1900. With the coming of the gold rush in 1898, even the pretense that Alaska was dry had to be discarded, and in 1899, President William McKinley signed a bill into law which legalized saloons and established an annual $1,500 licensing fee, equivalent to over $35,000 in 2014 dollars, with the funds to be used to support public education. Despite the fact that the first public schools in Alaska were built by saloon fees, in 1916, the citizens of the territory voted overwhelmingly in favor of prohibition, resulting in a draconian piece of legislation whose official title was the Bone Dry Law. Following the end of prohibition, Alaska decided to return to a system of licensing. In 1934, the territorial legislature voted to establish a board of liquor control. When Alaskans achieved their long-cherished dream of statehood in 1959, one of the first acts of the first Alaska state legislature was to create a three-member alcoholic beverage control board appointed by the governor. State liquor laws were adopted based primarily on the former territorial laws. In 1970, the ABC board was expanded to its current 5 members, with 2 being from within the alcohol industry and 3 being from the public. By 1978, there had been so many amendments to the alcoholic beverage statute that they had become contradictory and unenforceable, forcing the legislature to embark on a complete rewrite. In 1979, when the new legislation was passed, provisions were included to allow communities to prohibit either the sale or both the sale and importation of alcoholic beverages. In 1986, the law was amended again to permit communities to go so far as to outlaw even the possession of alcoholic beverages rather than just their importation and sale. Prohibition, as a local option, had returned to Alaska. Several rural Alaskan communities took advantage of the new local option, with some voting themselves damp, meaning they outlawed the sale but not the possession of alcohol, while others went dry, outlawing all possession as well as sale, with these prohibitions continuing to present day. Indeed, in some remote communities, individuals can be and are arrested for simply possessing excessive amounts of such mundane foodstuffs as sugar and yeast, on the theory that they intend to use them to produce home-brewed alcohol. In 1995, Barrow, a city of over 4,000 residents on the North Slope, became the largest in the state to ban the possession of alcohol. Currently, 77 communities ban both its sale and importation. Unsurprisingly to anyone familiar with the history of prohibition, this ban on alcohol has led to thriving bootlegging operations to smuggle alcohol into these locales. A bottle of cheap vodka that sells for $12 in Anchorage can be resold for $500 in a dry village. With profits like these, there is no shortage of Alaskans willing to follow in the footsteps of the bootleggers of old. Meanwhile, the Alaska State Troopers continue to try to shovel back the tide and stem the flow of illegal alcohol, just like Elliot Ness and the Treasury agents of old. To quote the immortal Mark Twain, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Speaking of history repeating itself, in 1974, there was another gold rush in Alaska. Or, to be more precise, there was a rush for black gold. The discovery of massive oil deposits on the North Slope necessitated the construction of the 800-mile-long Trans-Alaska Pipeline from the oil fields at Prudhoe Bay to the ice-free port of Valdez on Prince William Sound. To perform such a titanic feat of engineering, workers poured into Alaska from all over the world, creating a boom such as the state has never seen before nor has since. Before it was completed, some 70,000 men and women had a hand in the pipeline project. Wages were excellent, with skilled tradesmen earning double what they could have made working in the lower 48, plus free food and lodging. Overtime was the norm, especially during the long days of the Alaskan summer. During the winter, it really was the Klondike Stampede all over again, right down to the isolation that gripped remote camps when the winter storms closed the roads and grounded the flights to Anchorage. Alcohol was one of the few distractions available, and the workers made the most of it. To this day, Alaskans still tell tales of the wild doings at bars where pipeline workers blew their large paychecks on mad benders. The excesses of the pipeline boom era still cast a shadow over the state's liquor laws today. At that time, it was common for bars in Alaska to compete by offering happy hours with drink specials. Bars commonly offered 2 drinks for the price of 1, and 3 or even 4 drinks for the price of 1 during happy hour was not unheard of. Naturally, these sorts of offers encouraged massive overconsumption and gave plenty of ammunition to the anti-alcohol forces. As a result, during the 1986 revision of the state liquor laws, all such special drink offers were outlawed. Even in present-day Alaska, any discount in the price of an alcoholic beverage must be in effect for at least 1 week and must be offered to all patrons equally. A ladies' night with cheaper drinks for women or a happy hour with drink specials, so very common in the lower 48, are against the law on the last frontier. Today, the Alaska State Legislature is considering another complete overhaul of the state's alcohol licensing scheme. Its current iteration is Senate Bill 76. I hope to be interviewing Senate Bill 76 sponsor, State Senator Pete Michicki, next month here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, so be sure to tune in to hear what he has to say about it. If you're interested in learning more about the Alaskan history of alcohol in general and beer in particular, I would direct you to my book, Alaska Beer, Liquid Gold and Land of the Midnight Sun, which was published in 2015. You can find it at bookstores locally or on Amazon.com. This is Bill Howell of Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna, and we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell. We're moving on to this month's segment of The Science of Brewing. This month, we're going to be talking about malt. Malt's been called the soul of beer. It's the main fermentable providing the sugars that yeast use to create alcohol and carbonation. Malt has an influence on beer's aroma, alcohol level, body, color, flavor, and head retention. Barley is in many ways the perfect brewing grain. Not only does it contain a large reserve of starch that can be converted into sugar and a husk that makes a perfect filter bed, but barley contains the tools, in the form of enzymes, to do the job without adding anything but hot water. But unlike fruits such as grapes or apples, barley has some sophisticated defenses to keep yeast from consuming its sugars. First, grains like barley are armor-plated. A mature grain kernel has a skin so hard that no microbe or insect can penetrate it. Even we humans have to use stone or metal mills to crack it open. Then, once the grain is opened, the fuel within has more protection. It's not stored as a simple sugar, as in fruits, but as a long-chain starch molecule that is too big for microorganisms such as yeast to attack. If the sugar molecule is a brick, the starch molecule is a brick wall. When the yeast runs into it, nothing happens. That's where we humans enter the picture. We harvest the barley grain and then modify it via malting into something the yeast can consume. In return, the yeast produces the alcohol we want. We've been engaged in this partnership with yeast for thousands of years, though we've actually understood what is going on for less than 200. Basically, when we modify or malt barley, we trick the grain into believing it should sprout. We do this by soaking it in water. Fresh barley has a moisture content commonly around 13%. This is raised often to more than 40% until the barley begins to germinate. Enzymes in the grain begin converting the starch molecules into simple sugars to feed the growing plant embryo. Small rootlets called chits begin to emerge. At this point, we interrupt the process and dry out the grain in a kiln. Reducing the moisture content to less than 4% kills the embryo and stabilizes the grain with lots of nice simple sugars available for consumption by yeast. Malt is converted barley or other grains that have been steeped, germinated, heated, kilned, or roasted in a drum, cooled and dried, and then rested. The amount of time spent in the kiln or roasting drum and the maximum temperature reached are critical for determining what type of malt is produced. The Maillard reaction, sometimes called non-enzymatic browning, is the term used to collectively describe the chemistry of browning. It describes all the commonly encountered browning during cooking, including the char in a burger, the caramely goodness of sautéed onions, and the roastiness of chocolate and coffee. Thanks to its impact on barley during the kilning process, it's a major player in beer's flavor and appearance. There are four basic malt types produced. Base malts are lightly kilned and can serve as the basis for the entire brew. Even in the darkest beers, such as stouts, base malts will make up most of the grain bill. Pilsners, pale, Vienna, and Munich malts fall into this category. Kiln or lightly colored malts are used in small amounts, up to 20% of a recipe. Amber and brown malts fall into this category. Crystal or caramel malt is made in a special process where wet malt is stewed around 150 degrees Fahrenheit. The result is a glassy, crunchy texture and a wide range of caramel, raisin, or burnt sugar flavors. Roasted malts and grains include chocolate and various shades of black malt. Typically, these heavily roasted malts make up less than 10% of a recipe. The end result of all this is to produce barley malt, which the brewer can simply soak in hot water to produce the sugary wort, which will be the fuel for the yeast and eventually become a delicious beer. So that's it for this month's Brewing Science. Up next, our interview with Doug Hoag, owner of Kenai River Brewing Company. This is Bill Howell, Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, and we're here at Kenai River Brewing Company in the lovely tap room having a chat with owner Doug Hoag. So, Doug, you guys have been in business for 11 and a half years now, so tell us about how you got started.
Yeah, a long time ago. So when I moved to the Kenai Peninsula, I'd been teaching in one of the villages in the state. My wife and I got a job here. And my teaching partner, her husband, happened to be a home brewer as well. And I'd have been home brewing for quite a while. So we kind of got together a little bit and kind of noticed somewhat of a need in the community that there wasn't any microbrewed beer here besides Homer. Homer was like the start on the whole peninsula. So we decided to give it a shot, and we pulled our resources together and used our kids' money and started a shoestring brewery and got it going in a little 1963 cinder block building, and it went really well.
It was a car garage, right? Or auto mechanics place is what it started out life as?
Yeah, old car garage, all kinds of crazy things going on inside there. Typically Alaskan-built 1960s construction. So they built a section of building, and then they added on, and then they added a little bit more, and then, you know, it just kept snowballing from there. Sometimes it was the foundation, sometimes not. It was a great place to start. It gave us, I think, our character that we have. I think we brought some of that character with us. Maybe that's more the employees of the character situation, but we are definitely happy to be in Soldotna.
Hey, you guys started out so small, you didn't even have the whole building, as I recall. Next door, you had a hairdresser for quite a few years.
Yeah, the next door, when we first moved in, it was the office of the fellow that owned the place, and he was a civil engineer, and then we just had a very small tap room. When we first started, the law for a manufacturing brewery didn't allow us to sell anything for consumption on premise. So we could give you a sample and you could say, hey, I like that. And then you can grab a growler, take it out. We could sell a 5-gallon keg. And that was pretty much the extent of our retail business back in those days. We started to move into distribution, and it was a pretty tricky thing to break into in the community, because this was, again, almost 12 years ago, and the thought of local beer, while we had a few Homer Brewing Company things, we didn't have a lot of other breweries down here, so it was all the big name breweries that were here. And people were a little hesitant at first, and then we started to move in. I think people were talking about the product a little bit, and it really worked out nicely that we could distribute. Then the law changed shortly after that, and we were allowed to sell beer for consumption on premise. We started doing that, and that's where it kind of blossomed into the whole tap room scenario, where we were able to expand into the other side of the building after the hairdresser left, and then that was kind of the start of what our future would be, I guess.
So, Doug, why don't you clarify for our listeners who haven't been around for as long as the two of us have about exactly what the change in the law was that happened back in 2006?
In 2006, it allowed people with a manufacturing license, which is what we have, to not only distribute our beer, but to sell up to 36 ounces for consumption on premise. So people can come in, they can drink. What we do is a 12-ounce glass, and we serve three of those if people want to drink three, and that can be consumed right here in the tap room. And that just rolls right along with whether you're coming here for lunch or dinner, it's still 36 ounces. So three beers, which we feel at this point, I mean, that's great for a dinner time. And then as far as takeout beer, you're allowed to essentially purchase up to 5 gallons per person. So that equates into like a 5-gallon keg if you're going to have some kind of function, or you could take, some growlers that we also fill here.
So there's also some other restrictions on your tap room, right, that rules that you have to observe so that you're not seen as competing with the people with full liquor licenses?
Correct. We can't, in the tap room or outside on our property, have any live music. So there's no bands or musicians allowed. We can play some radio stuff, but that's basically it. No seats at the bar or where the alcohol is being served or poured from. So that's why when you come into our place, we have this big, beautiful bar, and people are standing there, because you can stand, but you can't sit. So that's another one of the big restrictions. There's no gaming allowed, so we can't have cornhole or horseshoes outside or any of those games. No pool tables, no darts, things like that. Yeah, just an essentially a little restriction on entertainment.
We're sitting here in your beautiful new tap room and your beautiful new brewery that you built a couple of years ago with food service and everything else. So obviously the tap room has become a huge part of your business. So why don't you talk a little bit about, from your perspective, how important your tap room really is to you?
Yeah, tap rooms for a manufacturing facility are huge because it provides that extra income, especially in the off times. And in the summer, it gives it that big boost. When people come to a tap room, they're used to what you see in a tap room in the lower 48. And that's, it's a brewery producing beer, and you can come in and enjoy that beer. And if you add the food component, which we chose to do, then it makes it, in my mind, a safer thing to do. So you're consuming craft beer, which can be a little higher in alcohol percentage. We limit what the consumption is, but you have food to kind of buffer that a little bit. So that's what we really like about the food part of the business. But when you just look at a tap room and a new brewery, it is very, very difficult to start a production brewery and immediately be distributing your beer. You don't have a proven product. You don't have a name. You have nothing except what you can get from your local community to start to build up your name and your reputation. So the only way to do that, obviously, is to be able to sell for consumption on premise. And it's a great model. It works across the United States. There are small breweries everywhere in every community now, and people are going in there and drinking, 75-80% of their product on premise. And that's the model that we see in the United States, and that is what really works for Alaska too. We have a lot of small communities, very difficult to distribute your beer. We only have so many bars and restaurants and so many handles in those bars and restaurants. So when you look at distribution, it gets to be a pretty tight market. So to be a new brewery and to expect that you're going to make your revenue from distribution is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I've read some stories prior to the new law being passed in 2006 where established breweries like Midnight Sun and Silver Gulch Brewing, it took them 5 or 6 years to get themselves in the black because all they could do was distribute their beer because they couldn't sell it direct, couldn't make any money doing that, and the margins on wholesaling beer are pretty darn slim. So from my perspective, I'd be interested if you agree with this, is that, it's really impossible for a small brewery like, say, Grace Ridge Brewing and Homer that opened a couple of years ago, or some of these others, Resolution and Anchorage, those breweries couldn't sell to the public. They just flat couldn't open.
Yeah, that's completely correct. It would be an impossible situation. When you do look at the margins in distribution, they're not super high. And you add everything else on, shipping expenses to get the grain and the hops and everything else up here. And we have awesome water, and that's cool. But everything else has to be brought to the state of Alaska for brewing.
So tell us a little bit about your plans for the future here.
We have a couple new things that are happening. The kitchen's become a huge part of Kenai River Brewing Company with our new food offerings and having a restaurant piece. And it's become popular enough that we felt we needed a bigger kitchen. So when I built the brewery, I knew a lot about production. We've been doing it for 10 years. And so the back part of Kenai River Brewing Company is perfect. It's exactly what we need. It's laid out exactly the way we wanted it. When it came to doing a kitchen, never did that before. And I've since found, and it's primarily due to the popularity, that we need more kitchen space. So we're going to expand out the back of the kitchen, and that'll be kind of fully operational by May 1st. And it's going to be about 240 square feet. So it's not huge, but it's going to allow our chefs to prep a lot better. We'll add an oven so we can do some baking, expand that menu a little bit, hopefully pull in some spent grain pretzels and things like that for some little appetizer deals. But yeah, we've got a baker on staff right now, and she does some awesome things. We have some slow times, and she brings some things out that are pretty amazing. So That's kind of on the tap room side, the new thing we're going to do. That'll be really, really good. And then back in the brewery, and it was part of the plan when we first opened the brewery, and we knew we had to do it, and it's finally going to happen, is we're getting a new canning line. And the canning line compared to what we have right now is it's a monster. It's going to be awesome. It's about 13 by 26 feet, and it has a depalletizer. So we will take an entire pallet of cans, which is almost 8,000 cans, put them in this machine. It'll automatically lift them up. It'll remove the separations between the cans automatically, moves them into a accumulation conveyor table, and then it drops them into like a twist rinser. So this is, we're talking about 11 and a half, 12 feet high at this point. And then it'll drop them into this rinser, and we're going to have deionized air that will shoot into each can, and that's going to get rid of any debris that could be in the can during shipping. And then it moves into the filler, which will fill right about 48 cans a minute, so it's pretty speedy. So it'll fill five at a time, counter pressure fill, which means that it locks down on the can. It'll shoot out all the oxygen that's in that can, and then it fills it with CO2, and then it fills the beer, so it's always on a layer of CO2. So really, really super low oxygen pickups, which preserves the beer even longer than a can does. Goes into a steamer, then it'll go into this little tunnel that will rinse the can off, and then it'll dry the can. And then each can will be date coded on the bottom, which is really good for tracking and so that we know, you know, if we would have a problem, we'd be able to find that can and or that batch and be able to pull that off. And then we're gonna have a little device that it goes through, and it senses if the can is low filled. So if maybe it got foam for some reason and it didn't quite fill up, well, that will then kick the can off the line, and then we'll just probably drink that later. And it goes then into another accumulation table where it'll move into a machine that will put the six pack toppers. So we use these little plastic pack tech toppers, and it'll snap those on. So we'll really be able to run two cases a minute with two operators, one person just monitoring the entire system, and then the other person pulling six packs and palletizing them and getting them ready to ship out.
How is this going to affect your production rate overall?
Yeah, so where this is really good is we have a little bit of a, I say a bottleneck, but it's our canning machine, so it's a can neck, I guess. And that is the slowness of our canner right now. Our canner is about, I mean, if we do 200 cases in a day, it's a long day. It's a long day to be able to do that. And our fermenters, at least our primary fermenter, holds 1,000 cases. So when we brew into that, we're talking almost a week before we get it all canned off and drafted and emptied and then filled again. So with this machine, we'll be able to completely empty the tank in a day and then clean it that evening. And then the next day, brewers come in and we are immediately filling it up again. So every one of our seven tanks, we're looking at a one-day turnaround, and then we're into that increased production without adding any tanks.
So we're back in the brewery now, and we're looking at the old canning machine that's going the way of all flesh. Have you got a buyer for it yet, Doug?
You know, I have not put it up for sale yet. So we're gonna, the plan is when we bring the new canning system in, we're gonna move this little guy in. You can see it's, what is it, like 8 feet long at the most, maybe seven. And so it's a pretty small machine, small footprint. So we'll probably move it off to the side, and then we'll continue canning on that until we have the big guy kind of fully armed and operational, so we can not back on that. Then I'll put it on the market and it'll sell. It's a, for a starting brewery, it is a awesome machine. We have it 100% dialed in. It's pretty incredible how it does function now compared to when we first got it, because when we first got it, we named it Hal, and we named it Hal for a reason, because it decided, I'm not going to do that today, Doug. So yeah.
So why don't you describe real quick how it works?
So this is called a semi-automated manual system here. So the manual piece comes in, we set the cans in line manually. then we will push them into the filler section, basically. So it'll drop down then automatically using sensors to be able to count the cans that are coming through. And it'll vac out those cans with CO2. And then it will actually fill three of them at a time. It's got sensors that will determine when those cans are full. And then it pushes those into the seam line. And it runs, when it's kind of running really good and everybody's on top of the game here, we run about 12 cans a minute. So it's not horrible, but it is when you need to do 800 cases in a day. So that can be bad. We manually put the six-pack toppers on. So we like that to a degree because we're big on kind of facing our cans. So as we're doing that, we're turning the cans. So then they go onto the display shelf. They're pretty. They look good. You can see Kenai River Brewing Company. You can see the logo. And with the automated machine, obviously, that's not going to happen. But we're trying to figure out how that might still work. So we're, trying to find some people with some fast hands.
All right. So looks like you're pretty busy this morning. I can see you got the brew team in here.
So we're actually, being Thanksgiving week, we're going to take the week off from brewing. So we're just doing some emptying tanks. We're going to clean the tanks. And then next week, we're going to hit it pretty hard with a number of batches, including a new batch from Andy, is one of our brewers. And he's been with us about a year now, and he is brewing his very first beer that he developed 100% on his own. So grain bill, hop schedule, yeast, the whole deal. So this will be his first all-inclusive, all Andy beer. So, and it's got a cool name, and Bill's going to love it. So we'll talk about that later.
Oh, you're not going to tell us? You're going to make us wait for this one?
Yeah, you got to wait. You got to come into the brewery and see what it's called.
All right. Thanks, Doug. You just had your first beer dinner, or your first fall beer dinner, I should say, because you had one last spring. But how'd that go?
It was great. It was a huge success. We kind of put the date out there a little bit to see what people were thinking, and we ended up choosing a date. So then I put it on for sale on a Friday morning, the beer dinner, and we had 70 seats available, and all 70 seats were sold out in 50 minutes. So it was a pretty quick sell. And then I can't even begin to say enough about our staff, both in the kitchen and the servers. It was absolutely an amazing dinner, considering we had 70 people filling this place, and the food was very timely. It was all warm. It was just incredibly delicious too. So yeah, five courses, and we paired that with 6 ounces of beer with each course, and it worked out really, really nice.
So you're going to be doing another one then?
We're hoping to do one. I'll throw it out there. Maybe kind of like around a Valentine's Day thing, but we want to do, it'll be a midweek, and it'll be before Frozen River Fest, which is on the 17th of February. So we like to do one before that, just to get people excited about the Frozen River Festival. And then hopefully at one of the other local places, we will do a formal beer dinner for the festival, where we can showcase beers from the state, basically.
Well, great. Thanks, Doug. I really appreciate you taking the time out from your busy day to talk to us, and wish you continued success. It's been a real great thing for the community. I think this tap room that you've opened here, everybody that I've talked to has had a great times here. I personally have really enjoyed every time I've come in to have a beer or eat. So keep up the good work, and looking forward to the kitchen expansion.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate the time to be able to talk about Kenai River Brewing Company.
This is Drinking on the Last Frontier with Bill Howell on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, and we'll be right back with our next segment. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. This is your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. It's time for our monthly segment on beer styles, and this month we'll be talking about holiday beers. Now that Thanksgiving is behind us, we are well and truly into the Christmas season. Whatever reservations you might have regarding the current state of the Christmas holiday in America, too commercial, too secular, too religious, too you name it, there's one thing we should all be in agreement on. Christmas beers are wonderful. You might think that beer and Christmas don't really go together, but you'd be very wrong. In fact, folks were brewing and drinking strong fermented drinks to celebrate the winter solstice long before there even was a Christmas. At Stonehenge and other sites, prehistoric peoples worshipped the sun and must have celebrated the solstice, likely with fermented grain. In Rome, at the time of the birth of Christ, the biggest festival of the year was the Saturnalia, held from the 17th to the 25th of December, a time when masters and slaves exchanged roles, gifts were exchanged, and pretty much everyone got rip-roaring drunk. Sounds familiar? The Vikings were no slouches either when it came to celebrating at this time of year. Imagine sitting in your dark and smoky Viking longhouse, wondering if this might be the year when spring wouldn't come, heralding Ragnarok and the end of all things. How happy would you be when the days finally stopped getting shorter and started getting longer again? Wouldn't you want to crack open a nice strong ale and celebrate? As Alaskans, we can sympathize. By 800 AD, Norwegian farmers were required by law to brew a strong Yule beer using a weight of grain equal to the weight of said farmer and his wife. Since this was before hops were used in brewing, these ales would have been flavored with berries, herbs, and spices. Over the centuries, Christmas and brewing both changed, but the tradition of brewing special strong ales for the holidays continued, and still does in many small traditional breweries in Europe. In America, Prohibition meant the end of Christmas beers, as it meant the end of so many other things. After repeal, some of the restored American breweries released Christmas beers, but most of them were just their standard beers in a slight differently decorated bottle or can. Christmas beers seemed destined to be relegated to the history books, at least in America. But when all seemed lost, craft brewers stepped up to carry on this proud tradition. Back in 1975, Fritz Maytag, owner of Anchor Brewing in San Francisco, and the man many folks consider to be the godfather of American craft brewing, decided to brew a Christmas ale. Fritz thought it was time to renew the ancient tradition of brewing something special for the holidays, and Anchor Brewing has done so for every Christmas since. The recipe used to brew the Christmas ale is different each year, though since 1987 the recipe has always included spices. Which spices? That's a secret that Anchor keeps to itself, so if you'd like to know, pick up a six-pack and guess with the rest of us. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, another pioneer of American craft brewing, began releasing a Christmas ale in the late 1980s. Their Celebration Ale is eagerly awaited each year by beer lovers around the world, who love to debate the virtue of each year's vintage as compared to the last. Unlike Anchor's Christmas Ale, Celebration Ale is not spiced. Instead, it's an amped-up version of Sierra Nevada's Pale Ale, being stronger, darker, and more hoppy. It's a fantastic beer, perfect for those long, cold winter evenings by the fire, and very widely available. Alaskan Brewing in Juneau produces their very interesting winter ale this time of year, though perhaps it's not strictly a Christmas ale, but rather a winter seasonal. It's in the style of an English old ale, malty and strong, but enlivened by the addition of Sitka spruce tips. Using spruce tips in beer has a long history in Alaska and harkens back to those pagan Vikings brewing their Yule ales and flavoring them with what they had at hand. Many other breweries in Alaska choose to celebrate the holiday season by releasing their barley wine sometime between Thanksgiving and Christmas. This is good timing considering that the annual Great Alaska Beer and Barley Wine Festival is held in Anchorage in mid-January each year. Whatever the exact style of the holiday beers released, they typically will pair very well with all the traditional holiday foods. In fact, they perfectly encapsulate the holiday slogan of eat, drink, and be merry. Whatever you choose to drink during the holidays, do it responsibly and enjoy the time with friends and family. Happy holidays. This is Bill Howell drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 Kenai Soldotna. We'll be back in a moment with our final segment, Beer Gear. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 Kenai Soldotna. In this month's Beer Gear, we'll be doing something a little different. Since it's the holiday shopping season, this month will be the best of Beer Gear 2017, a recap of the best products featured this year. It should help out if you are shopping for the beer lover in your life, or perhaps you might want to put something on your own wish list. We'll start with two great books. Tasting Beer by Randy Mosher. This completely updated second edition of the best-selling beer resource features the most current information on beer styles, flavor profiles, sensory evaluation guidelines, craft beer trends, food and beer pairings, and draft beer systems. You'll learn to identify the scents, colors, flavors, mouthfeel, and vocabulary of the major beer styles, including ales, lagers, wheat beers, and Belgian beers, and develop a more nuanced understanding of your favorite brews with in-depth sections on recent developments in the science of taste. Spirit drinkers will also enjoy the new section on beer cocktails. I like this book so much that it will be the text for the beer appreciation class that I will be teaching next semester at Kenai Peninsula College. It's available in paperback for about $15, or you can splurge on a hardback for just $6 more. The second book is The Beer Geek Handbook, Living a Life Ruled by Beer by Patrick Dawson. It's a toss-up between Randy Mosher's Tasting Beer and this book as to which was my favorite new beer book of recent vintage. I was already an admirer of Dawson's writings from reading his excellent Vintage Beer, A Taster's Guide to Brews That Improve Over Time, published back in 2012. This time round, Dawson provides everything you need to fully live a life ruled by beer, from the 10 Beer Geek Commandments and the Beer Geek Hall of Fame, to guidance on what to drink, how and where to drink it, how to gracefully correct an uninformed bartender, where to buy geek goods, how to flawlessly execute a beer tasting, how to plan the ultimate beer-centric vacation, and much more. It includes quizzes to help you determine your level of geekery, as well as witty illustrations by Greg Clestel. Every craft beer lover should read this book. It'll make you a better beer geek, I promise. Now that we're done with books, let's talk useful items. Good craft beer doesn't come with twist-off caps, so you'll need a bottle opener. Just to play it safe, I always carry one on my key ring. I like the Pickpocket from Pangea Designs. The Pickpocket is a keychain-sized titanium bottle opener with an integrated pocket clip designed to hang keys in a pocket rather than in an awkward clump at the bottom. It's made slim, lightweight, and minimal in size in order to keep the bottle opener virtually unnoticed on a keychain, and has the added versatility of the pocket clip further reduces the bulkiness of the keys. The Pickpocket Alpha was the first pickpocket to be introduced and features four holes along its body that may be used to attach additional key rings, lanyards, or accessories. You can find it for $20 on their website, www.pangea-designs.com. And the final item hardly qualifies as a gift since it's free, but it's still so cool and useful that I had to add it to the best of the 2017 list. This is the Craft Check app. Many of the craft-looking beers you see at your local grocery store are actually made by the same assembly line multinational beverage conglomerates you see advertised nationwide. So to help you distinguish the real craft breweries from the macro-brewed imposters, you need Craft Check. Just use this smartphone app to scan the barcode or search by brewery name to instantly find out whether the beer you're looking at is an authentic craft brewery or just a crafty imitation from the big guys. The app is regularly updated with information from the Brewers Association to ensure that it remains accurate. As I said, it's free, and it's something that's so handy, no craft beer lover should be without it. That's it for this month's beer gear. Hopefully that'll help you with your holiday shopping. And finally, for this month, our closing quote from that greatest of all writers, Anonymous. Every loaf of bread is a tragic story of grains that could have become beer. So I wish you all a happy holidays. Check with us again on our next show on the last Saturday of December. This is Bill Howell for Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM. Cheers. IPAs, ales and stouts, pilsners, porters too, microbrew, homebrew, any craft you choose. Look before you leap, sip before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think. Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn
here.